Well, the title of this course in Anglo-American poetry is Fields of Energy. Subtitle, 20th Century Anglo-American Poetry. While concentrating on certain high-energy figures on the British and American scenes, the course will attempt to trace a general trend and a gradual change of premise and promise in 20th century poetry, what it's fundamentally about and where it's going. Throughout, the insistence in this course will be on the poem as actual writing, an act of writing and an actual writing, opening, and there will be a great insistence on the word opening and beginning, opening a space of being, an act of writing opening a space of being. In general, poetry and poetics as, to quote one of the poets we'll be concerned with, Ezra Pound, a door permitting a man to enter a zone of activity out of fog and inertia. Poetry and poetics as a door permitting a man to enter a zone of activity out of fog and inertia. Well, after an introduction which will be concerned with outlines and with American space in particular, and I'll say later why we're insisting on American space, at least in the first instance, we'll be concerned with certain figures and fields. Remember, the title of the course is Fields of Energy. The figures we'll be concerned with are, and here's a list to which we'll adhere more or less exactly. Walt Whitman, and the title there would be The Opening of the Field. Walt Whitman is not 20th century, he's 19th century, but he's beginning something which will be taken up by later 20th century poets. Walt Whitman, then, The Opening of the Field. Thereafter, we move on to Ezra Pound. Ezra Pound. And there, the title of the field, the name we'll be giving to the field, will be The New Paiduma. The New Paiduma. P-A-I-D-E-U-M-A. The New Teaching, if you like. The New Paiduma. Thirdly, Hart Crane. Hart Crane. And there, the title will be, the theme will be American Psychosis. American Psychosis. Most of these poets, in fact, nearly all of them, at one time or another, refer back to Walt Whitman, hence the necessity of going back into the 19th century for Walt Whitman. Fourth on the list, William Carlos Williams. William Carlos Williams. And there the title will be Along the Passaic River. Along the Passaic River, where Ezra Pound leaves the States and moves through Europe. William Carlos Williams remains adamantly in the States, in a particular place, hence this particularly named place, along the Passaic River. Fifthly, we'll move on to E.E. Cummings. E.E. Cummings. And there the field, the theme, will be A Grammar of Anarchy. A Grammar of Anarchy. A Grammar of Anarchy. Sixth, Wallace Stevens. Wallace Stevens. And there the theme will be Ideas of Order. Ideas of Order. Thereafter, seventh, Robinson Jeffers. Robinson Jeffers, California poet, living way out in the West Coast. There the theme will be On the Edge. On the Edge. At the limits of something. That's a word which will come in frequently also. On the edge, at the limit. Eighth, Charles Olson. Charles Olson, he's away on the East Coast. Charles Olson, the figure of outward. The figure of outward. Like the prow of a ship advancing into unknown territory. Ninthly, Allen Ginsberg. Allen Ginsberg with his book Howl. And there the theme will be Holy Howling. Holy Howling. Tenthly, Gary Snyder, there we're in the 50s, 60s. Gary Snyder, The Way Down and Out. The Way Down and Out. And after these American poets, these American-born and largely American-placed poets, we'll come back to Europe. We'll have been leaving Europe, but it's an honor, in fact, to come back to it with, perhaps, a renewal of energy, a reclarification of our ideas, and the possibility of a new inspiration, a new work within the European scene. And coming back to Europe, we'll begin with an American poet who settled in Europe and worked there in London, T.S. Eliot. T.S. Eliot, and there the theme will be Wasteland and Still Center. Wasteland and Still Center. Wasteland and Still Center. And then we'll be concerned with three or four British poets, D.H. Lawrence, the Englishman, the wild Englishman. And there the theme will be the quick of time, le point vif du temps, the quick of time. Thereafter we'll move to a Welshman, Dylan Thomas. Dylan Thomas, Under the Stars of Wales. Under the Stars of Wales. And then finally, a Scotsman, Hugh MacDiarmid, and the theme will be a poetry of knowledge. A poetry of knowledge. All along, the theme will be a poetry not simply of the self, not only a personal poetry, not only of the word, not simply a kind of linguistic algebra, but a poetry of the world. I don't know exactly for the moment what kind of sense of poetry you have, but I'd like you to think of poetry in the following terms. I'd like you to think of a Frenchman. Well, he wasn't yet a Frenchman. He was a Greek of Marseille and Greek of Massilia, 4th century BC. And his name was Pythias, P-Y-T-H-E-A-S. And Pythias, 4th century BC, left the closed area of the Mediterranean and adventured out into the Atlantic Ocean, into the great ocean, into the unknown. He's moving along very, very difficult coasts, misty coasts, with reefs and rocks and cliffs. So he can't go too close to the coast because he's going to risk shipwreck. And he can't go too far away because he's going to lose sight of the lines and the outlines. So he has to keep a neat distance, not too close, not too far, waiting for insights into the line of the coast, waiting for visions, waiting for insights, waiting for the possibility of finding his way in these difficult waters and in this unknown territory. I'd like you to keep that as an image, as an analogy of poetry, the kind of poetry we'll be concerned with. In other words, the exploration of a space, an unknowingness, or an unknownness, an inconnu, an unknownness, gradually unfolding itself, un inconnu qui se dévoile petit à petit, an unknownness unfolding itself gradually, with now and then diamond clarities, with sudden flashes now and then, diamond clarities, and then the obscurity closing in again. The idea of feeling out a line, feeling out one's way through lights and obscurities, with, I'd like to think and hope, a sense of exhilaration, a sense of life opening before one. Now, keeping in mind this metaphor of space and poetry as a movement through space, a deployment of energy and movement in space, in an undefined space, that is one of the reasons why in this course I insist on, I concentrate on American space, simply because American space is a good example. Because up to recently, America was wide open space and still is to a large extent. But let me say right at the beginning of the course that the proposition, my proposition, goes beyond any specifically American context. We will be coming back into Europe And the space I'm concerned with is at one and the same time European, American, and Asian. But we're going to take American space as an example. Useful because, as I say, largely virgin territory up to recently. And because where in Europe we tend to have a feeling of, a rather constricted feeling at times, of ground which has been ploughed over and over again, overworked, or we may have the feeling of being constricted in a too nationalistic space, you know, one nation against another. In the American space, I say American space rather than United States. United States is a term of civilization. America is continental space, geographical space, and that's what we're concerned with. In America, the border is not between nation and nation, as in Europe, the frontier. The frontier is between the human and the inhuman. America is largely, was up to recently, and still is to some extent, an inhuman space. And here's an American poet speaking of American space, one of the poets we'll be speaking of later this year. Here's Charles Olson. Charles Olson, in a book called Call Me Ishmael. Call Me Ishmael. Ishmael, the lone figure of the Bible, the solitary figure. And here's Charles Olson speaking. I take space to be the central fact to man born in America. I spell it large because it comes large here, large and without mercy. It is geography at bottom, a hell of wide land from the beginning. I'll just go over it again, maybe a little slower. I take space, because it's a key quotation, I take space to be the central fact to man born in America. I spell it large because it comes large here, large and without mercy. It is geography at bottom, a hell of wide land from the beginning, a hell of wide land from the beginning. And here's another American writer whom we may refer to now and then, a 19th century writer, mainly a prose writer, Henry Thoreau. Henry Thoreau, in an essay called Walking, Walking and Moving Through Space. In Walking, we read this, and it's about American space and the possible contribution of America to a world culture. What we're concerned with is world literature, world poetry, world culture. Here's Henry Thoreau. The West is preparing to add its fables to those of the East. The valleys of the Ganges, the Nile, and the Rhine having yielded their crop, it remains to be seen what the valleys of the Amazon, the Plate, the Orinoco, the St. Lawrence, and the Mississippi will produce. Perchance, when, in the course of ages, American liberty has become a fiction of the past, the American dream, American ideology, as it has to some extent become a fiction of the present, the poets of the world, I insist on the phrase, the poets of the world will be inspired by American mythology. Now, by mythology, Thoreau does not mean stories about gods. He means a certain consciousness, a certain state of being, which is beyond the person, which means an enlargement of the consciousness, an aggrandizement of the person, a world feeling, if you like, a sensation of being in contact with a larger space than the personal, human, over-civilized one. That's what he means by mythology. Keep these two key quotations then in mind, and let's speak a little further of this sensation of space, this possible world opening. For most of us, when we're pretty young, our first introduction to American space is the Western. I'm not going to talk about the quality of Westerns, but the Western is a film, one of the main themes in which, I would say the main theme, is space. They are films concerned with a sensation of space, solitary figures moving through space. And let's just take the titles of some films, and I think the very titles are eloquent in themselves of this geographical thing, this spatial thing, which we're trying to get at. Here are just then a few titles of Westerns. The Big Sky, Colorado Territory, The Far Country, West of Montana, Across the Wide Missouri, Many Rivers to Cross, West of Wyoming, River of No Return, Along the Great Divide, 3,000 Hills. I don't think we need any commentary. You have this geographical, spatial thing in these titles, and it's a useful beginning for us. Let's look at the translations of these into French, the titles of the French versions. And then we're going to see a different sensation, a different mentality. The Big Sky, for example, becomes La Captive aux yeux clairs. In other words, we fall from a sense of space and geography into the small and the anecdotal. The overhuman and the anecdotal. Colorado Territory, le territoire du Colorado, becomes La Fille du Désert. We get a small story in place of a large space. Distant Drums, another title, becomes Les Aventures du Capitaine Wyatt. Sans commentaire. My Darling Clementine is the title of a song. A folk song in America becomes La Chevauchée Fantastique. Sans commentaire aussi. She Wore a Yellow Ribbon becomes La Charge Héroïque. So, we move away from space and geography into anecdote and a sense of simply little human stories. Let me give you another example of a difference between a certain American sensation, a certain world sensation, and a certain European attitude, mentality, consciousness, even ideology. We'll be speaking about Walt Whitman later on. Let's consider 1855, when Walt Whitman's book comes out, Leaves of Grass. The title is significant, Leaves of Grass. At the same time in France, a book appeared with a title which is at one and the same time similar and very, very different. The book I'm thinking of is Charles Baudelaire's Les Fleurs du Mal. On the one hand, then, Leaves of Grass, and on the other hand, Les Fleurs du Mal. On the one hand, Leaves of Grass, you're concerned with something absolutely ordinary. The most common growth there is, grass. The first growth, the beginning growth, anywhere. You're concerned with an open expanse. Leaves of grass, a kind of fluttering movement in an expanse, in a space. Leaves of grass. With Les Fleurs du Mal, Les Fleurs is already much more elaborate, much more aesthetic than grass. You have an aestheticism, Les Fleurs du Mal, and you have a morality, largely Christian morality. So on the one hand, you have a heavily weighted title evoking aesthetics and morality, even religion, and on the other, you have a title invoking something absolutely ordinary and a space. Henri Michaux points up that distinction between a certain Europe, we'll be trying to renew the idea of Europe, but a certain Europe and a certain America. Here's Henri Michaux in Un barbare en Asie. En Europe, tout finit en tragique. Il n'y a jamais eu attrait pour la sagesse en Europe, tout au moins après les Grecs, déjà bien discutable. La tragique de société des Français, l'Œdipe des Grecs, le goût du malheur des Russes, le tragique vantard des Italiens, l'obsession du tragique des Espagnols, etc., etc. Si le Christ n'avait pas été crucifié, il n'aurait pas fait 100 disciples en Europe. Sur sa passion, on s'est excité. Qu'est-ce que les Espagnols feraient s'ils ne voyaient pas les plaies du Christ? Et toute la littérature européenne est de souffrance, jamais de sagesse. Il faut attendre les Américains Walt Whitman et l'auteur de Walden, Henry Thoreau, pour entendre un autre accent. Alors on va essayer d'entrer dans cet espace de sagesse, pour utiliser le vocabulaire de Henri Michaux, et d'essayer d'entendre cet autre accent. There is a certain Europe we want out of, and we're going to move partially, temporarily, through a certain American space in order to come back into Europe with other ideas, with renewed energies. Now, Henri Michaux, when he says that there was never a literature of wisdom or a sense of space in Europe, was exaggerating a little. All throughout European culture, there have been people trying to renew the sense of space, trying to reinvigorate the culture. And one of them, to whom I'd like to refer this morning, is Chateaubriand. Chateaubriand, in so-called Romantic times, made a trip to America, and what he says is, I think, extremely interesting. First of all, you have this sensation of a new land, a new found land. In the memoir, because that's the book I'm referring to, you have a phrase like this. Le vent nous força d'anordir et nous accostâmes le banc de Terre-Neuve. Quelques glaces flottantes rôdaient au milieu d'une bruine froide et pâle. J'aime beaucoup cette phrase-là. Quelques glaces flottantes rôdaient au milieu d'une bruine froide et pâle. A first sensation of the American coast, of the American continent. In Chateaubriand, this is 1791, he had just left Europe in the turmoils of history, Europe in the turmoils of history, and he's trying to move into a geography. Chateaubriand meets the governor of the island of Saint-Pierre, Saint-Pierre-et-Miquelon. Et voilà, voici, this is what he says, voici ce qu'il dit. Il s'ennuyait dans cette retraite, convenable à un songe creux de mon espèce, rude séjour pour un homme occupé d'affaires. Mon hôte s'enquérait de la Révolution. Je lui demandais des nouvelles du passage du Nord-Ouest. It's the passage du Nord-Ouest, it's the Northwest Passage that interests Chateaubriand. Not news of the Revolution, not political news. Le passage du Nord-Ouest, he wants to make a passage. Il était à l'avant-garde du désert, this is Chateaubriand speaking of the governor of l'île Saint-Pierre. Il était à l'avant-garde du désert, and that's what we're going to try and get to the avant-garde, to the limits of the desert, of the open space. Il était à l'avant-garde du désert, mais il ne savait rien des Esquimaux, complete indifference to American ethnology. Il ne savait rien des Esquimaux et ne recevait du Canada que des perdrix. This governor is like the caricature often put forward of the courtesans of Versailles. It's been said that the definition which the courtesans of Versailles, a highly centralized territory, had of nature, the sense the courtesans had of nature, the definition they put forward was the place where birds are not yet cooked. L'espace où les oiseaux ne sont pas encore cuits. Well, we're going to try and get into a space where the birds and other things are very much alive. We're going to try and follow the roads of the new world. This is Chateaubriand still speaking about America. Les lettres sont inconnues dans la Nouvelle République. L'Américain a remplacé les opérations intellectuelles par les opérations positives. This is 1791. American literature was going to start around about 1820. It was really beginning of the 19th century. But Chateaubriand, for him, America is not a literary country at all. It's a country of business. It's a country of affairs. Chateaubriand again. Il n'y a dans le nouveau continent ni littérature classique, ni littérature romantique, ni littérature indienne. Classique, Les Américains n'ont pas de modèle. Ils n'ont pas de modèle. That's interesting. Having no models, they're going to be obliged to discover something else. Romantique, les Américains n'ont point de Moyen-Âge. N'ont point de Moyen-Âge. Which could mean, in positive terms, they're forced to move out of simple nostalgia, reaction, or memories, and move forward into unknown territory. Les Américains n'ont point de Moyen-Âge. Indienne, les Américains méprisent les sauvages. Whereas Chateaubriand, as you know, was extremely interested both in the new space, the space of the new continent, and in Indian culture. To move forward and to show that in France at the moment, since we are speaking and working in France at the moment, there is a big movement to recover this lost sense of space. Here, for example, is Michel Serres speaking in his book Détachement about what I'm going to be speaking about with you. Michel Serres, les nouveaux venus dans ce qu'ils appelaient le Nouveau Monde y ont massacré les Indiens et refoulé une extatique connaissance. Et refoulé une extatique connaissance peut-être déjà perdue. What we're going to try and get at is an ecstatic knowledge, une extatique connaissance. Michel Serres again speaks of, with reference to the American continent, un savoir prodigieux dont nous avons perdu la trace. Un savoir prodigieux. With poetry, we're concerned with discovery and knowledge. Not with simply a little pseudo-cultural addition to civilization. Michel Serres again, nous avons perdu les traces de ces choses, habitués que nous sommes à ne reconnaître que des signes ajustés. Nous avons perdu les traces de ces choses, habitués que nous sommes à ne reconnaître que des signes ajustés. Pure textuality. Whereas, in poetry, there can be much more than simple textuality, much more than a simply textual thing, but a world thing, a cosmic thing, a spatial thing, a living thing. Bienheureux, celui qui vit dans l'espace neuf, que ne ravage pas la relation d'ordre. And he contrasts l'espace fermé du drame, l'espace fermé du drame, these little human stories which we saw in the French titles of the American, of the French versions of the American films, l'espace fermé du drame on the one hand, and on the other, tout l'espace est le long du temps. Tout l'espace est le long du temps. So that's what we're concerned with. Let's now look rapidly, quite rapidly, just to renew our memory, look at the first occupations of American space, see what the possibilities were, and see what was missed out on. Because from the beginning, the discoveries tended to be mixed up with ideologies and with a certain amount of mental blindness. The very first people, of course, and don't let's ever forget it, the first real Americans, if you like, the very first people to move about on, to trade on American soil, were the Indians, whose origins are probably in Asia. Don't let's forget that either. They probably crossed the Bering Straits at the Paleolithic times, let's say about 40,000 years before our era, coming from Eastern Asia. And they are hunters and gatherers moving across the continent, taking their time, putting one foot in front of another, enjoying the trip, if you like. Here's an Indian chief speaking, and I read the French edition recently, so I'll quote it in French, in a book called Pieds nus sur la terre sacrée. And that was exactly the sensation, barefoot on the naked earth. A naked earth felt as sacred territory. And this is this Indian, this aboriginal, this primitive American, protesting at the attitude which the incomers, the newcomers, Europeans, had with regard to the land, the ground, the soil, the earth.
La terre a été créée avec l'aide du soleil et elle devrait être laissée telle qu'elle était. Le pays a été fait sans ligne de démarcation et ce n'est pas le rôle de l'homme de le diviser. La terre et moi sommes du même esprit. La terre et moi sommes du même esprit. La mesure de la terre et la mesure de nos corps sont les mêmes. Dites-nous, si vous l'osez, que vous aviez été envoyé par le pouvoir créateur pour nous parler.
The chief was Chief Joseph of the tribe called Nepersé. In around about 1932 to be exact, a book appeared by an American Indian. His name was Black Elk, Elan Noir. This book appeared in the United States and attracted no notice whatsoever. But books travel, books make their own way in very strange ways sometimes. And this book came to Europe. And let's insist on this from the beginning. Very often the most interesting things in the American context are discovered by Europeans in Europe. I mean, let's not be masochistic about Europe, huh? So Black Elk, in this book, which is called Black Elk Speaks, and Black Elk is a shaman, that's to say, a man who concenters the psychic energies of the tribe, and I'll suggest to you that this, again, is an analogy for the poets we'll be concerned with, poet, or the poet, as the man who concentrates the energies of the group, and he was able to speak in an inspiring way in order to revive the ambient universe, or at least revive consciousness of the ambient universe. Black Elk says this then regarding primitive Amerindian culture, the first American culture, the first American poetry. He says this about Wounded Knee, 1890, if you like, the fatal date for American culture, Amerindian culture. A people's dream died there. It was a beautiful dream. It was a beautiful dream. A people's dream died there. It was a beautiful dream. He says again, there is no center any longer, and the sacred tree is dead. There is no center any longer, and the sacred tree is dead. He says that people's minds are beginning to lose a sense of, and I quote, a sense of the beauty and the strangeness of the earth. The beauty and the strangeness of the earth. For people's minds nowadays, he says, this is simply matter to be exploited, not world to be lived with. However, he does say, not with any excessive optimism, but simply indicating a possibility, he says it may be that some little root of the sacred tree still lives. It may be that some little root of the sacred tree still lives. That's what we'll be trying to get at. After the Amerindians, after these first settlers of the American soil, there were probably, this is hypothetical, but it's possible, that there were certain Celtic monks around the 5th, 6th, 7th centuries, who may have reached the American coasts via Iceland and Greenland. There is a name you'll find in some of the old sagas and some of the old tales, Scotland, the land of the Scots or Irish. It's hypothetical, but keep it in mind, because we tend to think that America was discovered in 1492 by Christopher Columbus. People had been there before. Around the 10th century, there were the Vikings. The Vikings were, that we know, that is a fact, in America. And they called America, and to name a place is already a poetic activity, they called America Helluland. Helluland, the land of the flat stones. The land of the flat stones. They probably landed in Labrador. Or else, a little further south, Markland, the land of forests. the land of forests. This gives us a renewed idea, I think, of America. Or else, a little further south again, they called it Vinland. Vinland. Some people translate this as the country of vines. I think in Old Norse, I've read that in Old Norse, Vin did not mean vine, but pasture. So the land of pastures. So the land of the flat stones, the land of the forests, the land of pastures. And there was one place they named, which I think has a highly poetic energy, one place they named Furdustrandar, the surprising shore, the astonishing shore, the amazing shore. Let's try and keep this sense of an amazing shore, this sense of amazement and discovery. Moving on in time, there were certainly people around the maybe 13th, 14th, early 15th century, moving from the French coasts. Certainly, there were Breton and Basque fishermen moving towards the American coast, long before Columbus. Columbus knew about them, and he tried to get some maps from these people. One of the names given by the Basque whalers and the Basque codfishers to the American coast was Terra dos Bacalaos, the land of cod, the land of cod, because they went to the Newfoundland fishing banks. And there were Portuguese also, Portuguese and Spaniards long before Columbus, Corte Real, for example, who tended to sail under Norwegians. The Viking thing was still in the air. But we come, of course, inevitably, and he still is an extremely important reference, to Christopher Columbus. And here, with Christopher Columbus, we'll remain a little longer and see, on the one hand, as I said, the possibilities, and on the other hand, the failure to develop these possibilities. There's an edition of Christopher Columbus's notebooks, his carnet de bord, which appeared recently. And I'll be quoting from this. The editor of the notebook, a man called Michel Le Guen, speaking of the qualities required for this kind of trip, this kind of voyage of discovery, this kind of plunging into the unknown in the 15th century, he says the qualities were, and keep these in mind for poet as I intend to put forward the word, esprit d'aventure mêlé à de solides connaissances. Esprit d'aventure mêlé à de solides connaissances. Puissance de synthèse, a synthetic mind, able to make things cohere in new ways. Puissance de synthèse. Familiarité relativiste avec plusieurs contextes sociopolitiques, a sense of cultural relativity. Appartenance à un des pays maritimes de l'époque. Appartenance à un des pays maritimes de l'époque. And Le Guin writes concerning Christopher Columbus, il est, et sans doute était-il le seul à être, tout cela à la fois. Italien de naissance, catalan par engagement, portugais par accident, puis mariage, andalou par adoption et compagnonnage, espagnol par destin historique, négociant d'origine, corsaire par profession et goût de risque, explorateur et cartographe, quand il est happé par l'idée de l'heure, aventurier toujours, et au plus haut sens du mot, donc aussi poète. And here is Christopher Columbus noting in the margin of a treatise of cosmography in the 15th century. And his note is already, I think, a poem. It's an American poem. It's a world poem. Une partie de notre globe habitable se termine. Au soleil levant, par une terre inconnue. Au midi, par une terre inconnue. Au couchant, par une terre inconnue. Au septentrion, par une terre inconnue. Les quatre côtés de notre globe habitable sont fermés par une terre inconnue. And throughout the journal, throughout the notebooks, there are phrases which I think have poetic energy in them. For example, this.
il navigua sur le chemin de l'ouest. Plus de 40 pétrels et 2 albatros vinrent au navire. Une frégate vint à la nef, admirable, ainsi qu'un oiseau blanc, semblable à une mouette.
Strange birds, unknown birds, for which they have no names, are coming into this maritime space. There is this sense of discovery, this sense of freshness, un sens de la fraîcheur et de la découverte. Mais, but, there is ideology. There is not only discovery and freshness, there is also the transportation of an ideology. Hence, a blanketing of the new reality. For example, speaking of the Indians he met up with, Christopher Columbus says this, he's writing to European kings, ainsi vos altesses doivent se déterminer à en faire des chrétiens. Et je crois que, si l'on commence, en très peu de temps, vos altesses parviendront à convertir à notre sainte foi une multitude de peuples en gagnant de grandes seigneuries et richesses, ainsi que tous les peuples d'Espagne. Parce que sans aucun doute, il y a dans ces terres de grandes masses d'or.
So, from the very beginning, there was a desire to exploit to the maximum this territory. There was the unwillingness to learn anything from people who lived in this territory. On the contrary, there was a desire to convert them to an ideology coming from elsewhere. And it even goes further than that. At one point, Christopher Columbus sees a marvelous wood, a marvelous forest. And instead of simply, you know, marveling at this forest, he says this. Here we have this in the notebooks. L'amiral regarda vers la montagne et vit des pins si grands, si merveilleux, qu'il ne pouvait trop dire sur leur hauteur et leur droiture. Là, il en apparut qu'on pouvait faire des navires et sans fin des planches et des mâts pour les plus grandes nefs d'Espagne.
So immediately he turns this forest into so many planks.
And then there is the naming of the new territory. And again he's going to bombard names from elsewhere onto this unknown territory. Instead of trying to find names which are applicable to the new thing itself, à la première île que j'ai rencontrée, j'ai donné le nom de San Salvador. I mean, he could have called it the l'île inconnue, the unknown island, or something like that. En hommage à sa haute majesté, les Indiens appellent cette île Grandini. He could have given it the Indian name. J'ai nommé la deuxième île Santa Maria de Concepción. Sans commentaire. La troisième, Fernandina. La quatrième, Isabella. La cinquième, Juana. Et ainsi à chacune, j'ai donné un nom nouveau. Et c'est faux. Il n'a pas donné un nom nouveau. Il a donné un nom vieux. Il leur fallait essayer, peut-être, de donner un nom nouveau. Let's consider a Frenchman approaching American territory. This is Jacques Cartier. And again, you have this feeling of openness, of freshness and discovery. His book, Voyage de découverte au Canada, begins like this. Bref récit et succincte narration de la navigation faite aux îles de Canada, Rochelage et Saguenay et autres, avec particulière mœurs, langage et cérémonie, dit-elle, fort délectable à voir. That's Jacques Cartier. Fort délectable à voir. There is a delectation, a plaisir, une jouissance, an enjoyment. And here's Jacques Cartier speaking of the new lands. You have a sensation of plenitudinous reality. Force, maquereau, mulet, bar, sartre, grosse anguille et autres poissons. A sense of richness, of sensuous reality. And he sees birds. Il y a pareillement force grue, cygne, outarde et oie. And then he sees le dauphin. And this is an animal, fish, an animal fish, a mammal, which he's never seen before. It seems to him like the American, the body of America par excellence. Le lendemain au matin, fine voile et appareillant pour passer outre. Et une connaissance d'une sorte de poisson, desquels il n'est mémoire d'homme avoir vu ni oui. Les 10 poissons sont aussi gros comme morue, sans avoir aucun estoc, et sont ainsi faits par le corps et tête de la façon d'un levrier, aussi blanc comme neige, sans avoir aucune tache. Il y en a moult grand nombre dedans le dit fleuve, qui vivent entre la mer et l'eau douce. Il y en a moult grand nombre. The sense of multiplicity, of sensual reality, and of plenitudinousness. Keep that in mind. Then you have the English coming in. John Cabot, Henry Hudson, Captain John Smith, the Mayflower. I'm interested less in the Puritans, the Puritan settlement of America, which of course was very, very important, in fact, which dictated 80 or 90% of the reality of America. But I'm much more interested in the equivalent of the French coureurs de bois, the hunters and the trappers. Daniel Boone, for example, who adventured on his own into the land of Kentucky. Or these people described by the Spanish governor of Louisiana in 1794, he says, a gun and a little maize in a bag are enough for a lonely American to wander for a month in the woods. In other words, needs reduced to the minimum and a body moving through this unknown space. Trappers and mountain men, seeing the country for the first time, looking for a language for this unknown country. And these mountain men, these hunters and trappers, tough guys, were reading poetry. They were reading a lot of poetry because they were looking for a language for this unknown thing they had before them. These men were crossing the Great Plains, the first Europeans to cross the Great Plains, with the Chinook howling around them. This is the Chinook, one of the winds, one of the American winds. They're crossing the Rocky Mountains. They're seeing the Pacific for the first time. And they're reading. They have books with them. They have the Bible. They have biographies. And they have a great deal of poetry. And it's that poetry we'll be going further into next week.